These are exciting times for cricket in Ireland. 2 weeks ago, Owen Morgan from Rush, County Dublin, captained England to win the one-day cricket World Cup. Then, last Wednesday in London, Ireland began their first ever test match against England in dramatic style. England were bowled out for a record low score of 85 before the break for lunch. A test game is normally scheduled to last 5 days. There are now 12 test-playing countries. A country must be awarded first-class status by the International Cricket Council to be eligible to play test cricket. Ireland was awarded first-class status in 2017 in recognition of the fine displays it's given in shorter forms of the game over the past 20 years. Cricket traditionalists say that test cricket is the purest form of the game. They say that watching a five-day test is akin to reading a great novel. The fortunes of both teams rise and fall as the sun winds its way across the sky each day. Modern life has taken from this view of the five-day test. Many now see test cricket as being too long and boring. In a world of tweets and Instagram, shorter forms of the game, versions that last one day or less, are now the popular choice. And that may be so, but for Ireland to be awarded first-class status means our country has taken its place at the top table of the sport. What is not well known is that test cricket status could have been achieved a long time ago. Back in the 1880s, Ireland might have become one of the great powers of international cricket if only two members of the Central Council of the GAA had voted differently one Saturday afternoon. On that forgotten day, the founder of the GAA, Michael Cusick, himself a former cricket player and admirer of the game, made a bid to have cricket included as an official sport of the Gaelic Athletic Association. The proposal was defeated by 8-6 after a debate. Just imagine Kilkenny's Henry Shefflin, all padded up, dressed in white, striding out to bat for Ireland. Or Dublin speedy halfback James McCarthy hurtling in and bowling at 100 miles an hour to some unfortunate England batsman who can only lean back out of the way as the ball whizzes past his nose. Michael Cusick, a rotund bearded man with an impressive presence, imagined this. And if he had won the vote that day, the shape of Croke Park today itself might be more rotund than square. Over in England at that time, there was another rotund bearded man who had just as big an aura and presence as the founder of the GAA. His name was William Gilbert Grace, and he was known simply as WG. He was then, and still is, regarded by many as the greatest cricket player of all time. WG was a paradox. His skill with the bat and his devastating bowling represented everything that was good about cricket to the upper classes of Victorian England. He was a doctor. The fact that he played cricket as an amateur was a major fillip to the cricketing gentry. Professional players were at that time gaining a strong foothold in the game. And yet, for all his style and his amateur status, WG was no gentleman Jim. He knew his worth. And knowing it as he did meant he exploited his talent as well as any professional player. When WG Grace played a game, it often meant the admission fee increased from 3 pence to 6 pence. So WG demanded an appearance fee. As a practicing doctor, he claimed these fees were legitimate expenses. He famously demanded and received a fee of £1,500 for touring Australia with England in 1874. The professional players were given a fee of £200 for the same tour. As WG's reputation grew through the years, so did his ability to bully and intimidate both umpires and opposition players. He was, it's said, never a good loser. Legend has it that once, when an umpire gave him out, he refused to leave the field. He boldly stood his ground and told the umpire, "The people have come to see me bat, not to see you umpire." W.G. Grace played in Ireland on a number of occasions. He made his last appearance in 1903, playing for the London Cricket Club. London played Trinity College in Dublin and then travelled to Cork to play the Gentlemen of Ireland at the Mardyke Cricket Grounds. It was here, at the home of the Cork County Cricket Club, the bearded wonder was finally taught how to behave on a cricket field. A large crowd attended the Mardyke that day. London batted first. Grace strode to the middle of the field and prepared to face the Irish bowling. All seemed normal when he scored one run off the first ball. His batting colleague then scored one run off the next ball, which brought WG back to bat again. It was then that calamity struck the great WG. The bowler bowled a difficult ball to Grace. The best WG could do was to pop the ball into the air, and an Irish fielder took a clean catch. The umpire raised his finger to signal that WG Grace was out. Grace threw a tantrum. He refused to leave the field, claiming the catch was unfair. The umpire stood his ground too. "Out," he repeated. The stalemate was broken when Cork County Cricket Club member Sir George Coldhurst, of Blarney Castle fame, walked onto the field and had some strong words with the stubborn cricketer. What exactly he said to Grace, we will never know. But after this exchange, Coldhurst and a chastened Grace were seen to walk together from the field, with Grace apologising to the umpire and the bowler as he left. A lot has happened since WG Grace and Michael Cusick changed the sporting landscape of Ireland and England over 130 years ago. I wonder if those two robust, vociferous and bearded gentlemen who dedicated so much of their lives to sport ever foresaw a test like we've had over the last few days, when the Ireland and England cricket teams finally tested their skills against each other in the highest form of the game.
In the course of my so-called career as a poet, I've often found myself giving poetry readings in many different locations, apart from the obvious ones of libraries, colleges and theatres. Although I do participate in them, I've always had mixed feelings about poetry readings, either by myself or others, usually preferring to hear the poems in my head. As Mary Heaney once famously remarked, there's no such thing as a poetry reading which is too short. As a young poet in the 1970s, I gave many readings as it seemed the thing to do. The end came when myself and my friend Dermot Bulger set off on a nationwide tour of art centres, accompanied by a punk band called News for the Deaf, who thankfully broke up after our first gig in Wexford. I'd had enough. After that, I managed to avoid readings for decades, till I was persuaded that in this day and age, it's the only way to get people to buy and maybe even read your slim volumes. So, reluctantly, I cleared my throat and started reading in public again. But perhaps because of my distaste for the straightforward poetry reading, I've always had a fondness for doing it in unorthodox situations, particularly because it brings you into contact with a different kind of audience. For a number of years, Poetry Ireland sponsored me to read poems in Dublin Airport on National Poetry Day. I would simply pop up at gates where passengers sat waiting to board and announce myself to the bemused travellers, then read one of my poems, usually related to travel or emigration. The response was surprisingly positive. At the gate waiting for a flight to Stockholm, a Swedish woman enthused, "That's what I love about Ireland. You'd never get something like this in Sweden." Another memorable reading was to celebrate Bastille Day in the garden of the French ambassador's elegant residence on Aylesbury Road. As glasses of champagne and whiskey sours circulated, I read a poem I'd written specially for the occasion. Afterwards, a portly gentleman in a blazer congratulated me and asked, "Did you write that yourself?" Another audience member told me that when the ambassador announced that I was about to read a poem, his wife had said, "Oh God, no." "But you know what," he continued, "when you were finished," she said, "that wasn't bad at all." I thought I'd seen and heard it all, but that was until I travelled last November to Prague to take part in a poetry festival. The organiser asked me if I'd be interested in going on what she called a peripheral walk, organised by Josef Strana, a poet known as the Flaneur of Prague. I said sure, but was unsure of what exactly I'd signed up to. And so, on a freezing night, I found myself with a group of poets from America, Iceland, Russia and Czechia, standing at a metro station in a peripheral district of Prague, as the audience gradually swelled, emerging well wrapped up from the escalators. Then we set off walking, led by a local historian, following lines of desire across building sites, scrambling up embankments and traversing abandoned train stations. I soon found myself standing on a pile of building materials, reading a poem about my childhood on the Dublin periphery. We then walked through what they said was the longest underground pedestrian tunnel in Europe. I read a poem deep underground in the dazzling fluorescent light, my back to the white tiled wall, with our walking audience supplemented by some local youth and their pit bulls looking at me in respectful puzzlement. The walk was to end after a couple of hours with a poetry reading in a local tavern. But the place was jam-packed, as it was St. Martin's Day, a day when everyone in the Czech Republic goes to a restaurant to eat the traditional roast goose. Josef was upset. "They promised us a quiet room at the back," he said. "We'll have to cancel the reading." But my mind went back to a reading I'd done a few years ago in the famous White House pub in Limerick. I had read to a bunch of poetry enthusiasts at one end of a room, with, at the other end, a bar, where a mass of natives were roaring at a rugby match on the big screen TV, accompanied by the merry laughter of the cash register. "Don't worry," I told Josef. I drained my tankard of delicious black beer, stood up, introduced myself, and read a poem I'd written about Prague the year before. The Czechs are a polite, quiet people, and the noise level dropped as they listened with some curiosity, with even the harried waiters clutching bunches of foaming tankards in each fist, delicately swerving around me. There was a ripple of applause when I sat down again to a freshly delivered tankard, and I couldn't help thinking, this may well be my most successful poetry reading ever.
When I see my baby, what do I see?
When I was 9 or 10, I tried to map the night sky. Alone, standing in my stepfather's garden, one dark velvet night in the Channel Island of Jersey. It's still a vivid memory. I'm gazing at an upturned bowl of blackest blue that arches way, way above. Gazillions of glinting stars pinprick the sky, many crystalline and sharp, countless others embedded in trails of silver dust. This is a vast picture show right outside the back door. I rush inside to get some paper, a pencil and torch. Then I start with the plough, the easy bit, 7 large stars and a few close by. I do my best, then go back in for a ruler, possibly a dressing gown too. When I start again, now randomly filling my page with stars, panic sets in. The angles look wrong. I rub out some stars and relocate them. Can't remember which ones I've already drawn. Are they moving? Back then, I'd no smartphone app or Google, just a compulsion to grasp and record what I was witnessing, like so many before me. The ancient Egyptians were transfixed by the stars. In their mythology, the mother goddess Isis created the Milky Way with scattered wheat grains. They believed the sun god Ra travelled across the sky each night to pass through the Duat, or realm of the dead. He re-emerged each morning, fiery and youthful, to warm the earth. Early Egyptian astronomers even mapped the Duat with their instruments. Ptolemy created a star catalogue and major astronomy text almost 2,000 years ago. He rejected Greek myths, being a mathematician and scientist, but believed the stars helped influence our human lives. Indeed, he wrote a 4-volume book on astrology. The Ottawan Indians have a more beautiful story. It tells how a giant turtle swam through the universe, its swirling feet speckling the sky with mud, each particle turning into a tiny star that now forms part of the Milky Way. Native Americans revered turtles, crediting them with wisdom, spirituality, and the creation of our planet. What stunning skies they must have watched on sultry summer nights, resting by their teepees. Today, science explains all. We know the Milky Way is a stellar system comprising hundreds of billions of stars and planets. That our solar system is cradled in one arm of this barred spiral galaxy. And that in the night sky of the northern hemisphere, we catch a sidelong view of two immense disks some 100,000 light years across. But we humans still need to stargaze, to have a dark sky experience that simply astounds us. Fortunately, two areas in Ireland, one in Kerry, the other in Mayo, have gold tier awards for the quality of their night skies. Light pollution is minimal. These are places where, on a really dark night, the naked eye can see up to 2,000 stars. One July night in West Kerry, I had a second rare encounter with the Milky Way. It was on leaving Brick's Pub near Wine Strand on the Dingle Peninsula, just after midnight and a few hours of music, chat and pints. Clear-headed, but stumbling in total darkness, my husband, our friend Dermot and I walked the half mile back to our rented cottage. The sky was clear and there were no houses to block our view, just a low hedge boreen and the sparkling sea ahead. The stars pulsated with warm, twinkling energy. Wondrous, out there, inviting celebration and joy. Amazed, we summoned our daughters, both still awake, outside the cottage. This is incredible. Really worth seeing, we promised. And it was. Since then, I've learned that the island of Sark in the Channel Islands was designated the world's very first dark sky island in 2011. Sark has no public street lighting or cars, thanks to its unique and quirky laws. The island's 500 inhabitants use very little electricity. Most importantly, to me anyway, Sark is less than 20 miles from Jersey, where my fascination with the night sky first began. I don't have a bucket list, but I do have a plan. One summer day, when funds permit, I'll take a ferry from Jersey to Sark, then a tractor ride to a hostel or B&B along the island's long, narrow road. Around midnight, after praying for a warm, cloudless night, I will step outside with my family, or alone, perhaps, and I will tilt back my head and drink in those stars.
I met Maeve Binshee through my uncle, Donal Foley. He was the well-known journalist, news and deputy editor of the Irish Times, who spotted her talent and recommended her for her first job in journalism. Ever afterwards, they were great friends. And one year, when they came together with their respective spouses to visit us here in County Waterford, I met Maeve. I especially remember how I was a tongue-tied teenager, but Maeve was a skillful communicator, and once I got chatting to her, as if by magic, she had winkled it out of me that I wanted to be a writer. Even though I had rarely, if ever, given voice to this secret ambition before. "Well," she said, "if you are interested in writing, I'd love to help, and I'll give you whatever advice I can. So come to me when you are ready." Some years later, when I was in my early 20s, a young teacher in Tipperary town, working late into the night trying to write a story, her words of support came back to me, and I decided to send off what I'd written to her. As the weeks passed, I waited nervously to hear back. Would she see its brilliance and tell me that she loved it? Would she tell me that my life as a writer was about to take off? I lived both in dread of her response and yet also in expectation of some life-changing news. And in due course, she did write back. My hands trembled as I opened the envelope. Inside was a long, typed letter with a critique of my story. She began by warning me that if I was going to be a writer, I'd have to be able to take the criticism. I swallowed and read on. She continued, saying that if I felt it was all too much, then I wasn't going to make it. My heart sank as I read this. She pointed out the clichés I had used in my story and the stilted language. She said I'd have to banish unnecessary words from my writing and make it simple. It was far too formal, she said. She underlined the offending phrases so that I'd see what she was talking about. This was not real, conversational, easily read English, she wrote. She advised me to make my story more dramatic and gave me suggestions as to how I might do this to improve it. This letter was written just 2 years after her first great novel, Light a Penny Candle, had been published, and she was well on her way to becoming a huge star. In conclusion, she wrote, if I hear from you before Christmas, I will know you are serious about this and it will be a pleasure to help you. Your uncle gave me my start and chance in life and I'll never forget it, even if I live to be 100. As well as her advice, there were some positives woven through the sentences. She said my story was moving and attractive. But in spite of the praise, the letter was more than I could bear and I put it away from me, hardly able to get to the end. I was a very delicate flower at the time, given to huge self-doubt and self-recrimination and in dire need of affirmation and praise. Even though she said she'd watch out for my return letter, I knew I would not pursue the matter. I wrote a thank you note, but I never felt able to send her a revised version of my story. But I did keep writing. It was over 20 years before I met Maeve again. I was a reporter then, and I was sent to interview her for an article. She was the star of an event that had been organised to raise money for a charity. She was an internationally famous writer by then who was always generous with her time. She was as warm and friendly as ever, with a dazzling smile and those twinkling, all-seeing eyes. She asked how my family was, and she gave me a fine comment for my story. But I didn't mention the letter, and neither did she. After that, I met her on a number of occasions. I'd often ask her for a comment or a pithy quote, and she'd always oblige. But I never alluded to the fact that she'd once given me advice about writing. Even all those years later, I could still feel the awkwardness of it lodged in my craw like something that was too hard to swallow. I remember in particular the unveiling in the National Gallery of her portrait by artist Maeve McCarthy, when I felt her warmth towards me. I wish I'd told her then how grateful I was for her advice, because it's only now, as I reread her letter, that I can finally fully appreciate the spirit of generosity and matter-of-fact kindness in which it was written.
I catch my first whiff of aviation fuel boarding a 737. It's the summer of 73. I am barely 15. Everything seems possible. Monsieur's white Renault sprints between traffic lights along tree-lined cobbled streets. No English is spoken. We access the first floor apartment through a quiet courtyard. Madame, short-haired, spectacled, wears a dark skirt and cardigan. She is rattling away on the telephone to the school principal because her son has just been expelled. I am offered tea in a china bowl. Gradually, I immerse myself in this strange stage set of rich velvet and old furniture. After a few days, Madame asks me a question about her son, who sleeps in the same room as me, never looks me in the eye, keeps a snake in a box under his bed, and hardly speaks. Est-ce que tu penses qu'il est normal? Oui, I venture weakly, not knowing how to respond. Sometimes Madame is maudlin, plays her cello. I watch how she must hold the instrument to make the hollow, plaintive sound. Everything is possible. Madame says her favourite writer is Victor Hugo. She forbids all English, even the dictionary, shows me how to recognise Louis XIV's furniture, teaches me a poem by Paul Verlaine. In the poem, a man looks out the window of his prison cell to a clear blue sky. A bird moves in a tree. Branches move in the wind. A bell gently tolls. The man asks, "What has happened to my youth?" Monsieur is short and solid. In the evenings, he returns and holds out his hand. Madame puts money in his palm, but does not embrace him or ruffle his short hair. He comes back with beer and gitane, opens the cupboard where they hide the television. I memorise the theme tune of the TV soap. Cupboard closed, déjeuner is an endless series of courses. Vin de table, heavily diluted, then a card game, Le Barbu. There is a chateau nearby with a long terrace overlooking the city. Madame conducts picnics in the forest beside the chateau. I gorge on apricots and peaches. French words slip from my lips. On Bastille Day, they are excited. Monsieur flings petards down laneways and between parked cars. We watch the fireworks begin in the city centre and loom ever nearer until it is the turn of Saint-Germain-en-Laye to explode. One Saturday, Monsieur takes me to a brocante antique shop. I find a painting. Monsieur tells the dealer it will be a present for the Irish boy's maman. My heart swells at the mention of my mother. Monsieur haggles, and I get it for a song. The painting is a view of Paris rooftops and churches. There is an airship circumventing the Tour Eiffel and an inscription from the artist to Santos Dumont, who is the airship pilot. Everybody knows Dumont is the father of French aviation. Everything is possible. Monsieur is obsessed. He mounts the painting on an easel in his bedroom, cleans it every night with pieces of rolled-up bread, makes measurements, draws tangents, works out precisely where in Montmartre the work was painted, takes me there. We take a photograph, note which buildings did not survive the war. We go to a library, research the artist, Paul Franz Namur. I sense this is something important. I imagine the painting in the National Gallery in Dublin. By now I have been to the Louvre and the Georges Pompidou. I see my mother giving a lecture on the pioneers of French flight. She is radiant in an elegant Parisian dress. Everyone is applauding, smiling. Everything is possible. I know Monsieur will not want to part with the painting. Every evening as I pass their bedroom, I see him before the easel. One night I am shocked to see Monsieur naked, tangled in sheets, snoring loudly. I've never seen my father like this. But I just can't keep a secret. I write to my mother on flimsy airmail paper, tell her I'm bringing home a treasure. I write par avion on the envelope. My mother passed away 3 years ago. The painting hangs in my home. Going through her keepsakes, I find an airmail letter dated 16th of July, 1973. I gaze at Santos Dumont's dirigible circumventing the Tour Eiffel, reflect on a life where everything was possible.
The Laughing Chimney Sweep, Connemara, 1847. Pure as the driven snow, the boy of eight or so is running west, fast, away from cruel employers in the city. Running barefoot, almost naked, 60 miles into Connemara, smudges of soot on his pale white skin, a piece of sacking tied around his waist, a small hoe under his arm. "Do you not feel the cold?" asks the English gentleman from his carriage, intrigued by this Irish curiosity. "And where do you keep your money?" "In my fist." "And what do you do when your two hands are full?" The boy is on his way to sweep the chimneys in the police barracks, has just swept for the local priest, says, "I will fall upon a plan when my hands are full of money," throws his head back and laughs, 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 and runs again. And we will never know. Did he fall among the frosted rock and heather, or pay his fare to go?
On this morning's programme, we heard Ireland Cricket, Michael Cusack, W.G. Grace and All That by Diarmaid O'Donovan. My Most Successful Poetry Reading Ever by Michael O'Loughlin. The Milky Way by Gail Seacamp. Maeve's Letter by Catherine Foley. Everything is Possible by Garrett Igo. And The Laughing Chimney Sweep, a poem by Vincent Woods. The music was When an Old Cricketer Leaves the Crease by Roy Harper. Poetry in Motion by Johnny Tillotson. Stardust by Django Reinhardt. I Can See Clearly Now by Johnny Nash. And Sicilienne in E-flat by Maria Theresia von Paradis, played on cello by Jacqueline Dupre with Gerald Moore on piano. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE radio player, and further details are available on rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.